Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Amid the controversy over the Bush administration's secret domestic spying program, there's a new report today of a covert surveillance effort on the part of New York City police. A New York Times report says videotapes of the surveillance effort show that over the past 16 months, undercover police officers attended various demonstrations, such as anti-war protests, and bicycle riders taking part in rallies called Critical Mass. The tapes also show that officers sometimes masqueraded as participants in the demonstrations and had an effect on what was happening. Joining us is the reporter who wrote this story, Jim Dwyer of the New York Times. And Jim, why would police officers videotape these public rallies and disguise themselves as participants?
The police department says they're there to make sure that no one causes any trouble, throws rocks from the middle of a crowd, or in the case of the bicycle rides, decides to block traffic. Some of the activists who are involved think that the police are collecting names and data about them and are doing more than simply policing the event for public safety issues, but are targeting in particular people whose political views are maybe extreme or regarded as extreme.
So this has always been going on as part of law enforcement?
Well, what happened all over the country and in New York, which has the largest police department by far, in the 1960s, was that there was a great deal of surveillance and infiltration by undercover officers and agents into a lot of political groups. And there was a huge counter-reaction to that in the 70s. And as a result, the surveillance at First Amendment events was one of the most tightly controlled and limited police activities as a result of all the reforms that came out in the 1970s. So after 9/11, everyone from the FBI down, to the NYPD began to expand their authority in this area.
Mm-hmm. Your story mentions a sham arrest at the Republican National Convention. What happened there?
Well, a man was standing on a sidewalk holding a sign, a protest sign of some sort or another, and suddenly didn't seem to be doing any particular mischief that I could see on the tape. And he was abruptly grabbed by a police lieutenant, searched, and led away. And as he was being led away, people in the crowd started shouting, "Let him go, let him go." And some people chased after him as he was going down the street and hollering at the cops. The result was that riot police in batons and gear pushed back against the crowd. Some people got thrown around, and there was several arrests. In addition, when you look at the videotape very carefully, you see that the man whose original arrest, seeming arrest, set off the event, when they unzipped his bag, you could see that he had a two-way radio in there, and when they led him away, his hands were clasped behind his back, but he actually wasn't in handcuffs, which was highly, highly unusual and suspicious. And in fact, he was around the very next day at other protests.
So he was a police officer. He was an undercover police officer, at least.
Well, I wouldn't conclude that necessarily he's a police officer, but he had some kind of relationship with the police. It's possible that the police department has, infiltrators or informants or so forth that they work with, or maybe he was a police officer. In another case, it was very, very explicit that the people involved were police officers. There's three of them riding down with one of these mass bike rides that take place once a month in New York and a number of other cities. And they hit a blockade, and as people were starting to get arrested, one of these three people, there's a large group of people getting arrested, but one of these three that we believe are undercovers, said on tape, "I'm on the job," which is cop lingo for "I'm a police officer."
Mm-hmm.
And the uniformed officer who was arresting him called out to his lieutenant, "He's under." And then they let him down the block, and he got back on his bike and rode away. The other two people he was with were actually put into handcuffs, but about 20 minutes later, and they were loaded into a van, but about 20 minutes later, they were back on the street patrolling on the other side of town.
Mm-hmm. I guess if these powers of police to do this type of thing have been expanded since 9/11 for terrorism investigations, what's the justification here for how this particular infiltration of a bike rally might be related to terrorism?
The police department says they haven't used their expanded anti-terrorism powers for stifling political dissent or these kinds of events. that all they've done is what they say they've always done, which is police events in a, you know, in a subtle way so that they can keep an eye on lawbreakers.
There is a sidebar to your story as well.
Yes.
About a special helicopter that has
yes,
night vision and right. captured a rather embarrassing moment for a couple in New York.
Yeah. Right, that's right. Yeah, there's the city got $10 million in counterterrorism fund and for a spy helicopter, essentially, that can read a license plate from 1,000 feet away and can see in the dark. So one night, a couple were sharing an intimate moment on a penthouse terrace. I thought they were completely in the dark because it was very late, and they were surrounded by shrubs and hedges up there. Didn't realize that the helicopter that was overhead was actually filming them for nearly 4 minutes.
Hmm.
They were not amused.
And they filed a complaint.
Yes, the man filed a complaint. The woman is so upset about the whole thing, she doesn't want to know about it, hear about it, talk about it.
And that aired on television?
Yes, one of the local TV stations broadcast that a few months back. It was a PG moment, let's say.
Okay. Well, Jim, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jim Dwyer is a reporter for The New York Times. And this further note about New York City, it appears that some progress has been made in the transit workers' strike. A mediator says that the workers have agreed to go back to their jobs while negotiations between the union and the transit authority continue. Earlier today, both sides were seen going into the hotel where previous talks have been held. It's unclear when bus and subway service might resume and whether the afternoon commute for millions of riders will be any easier than the frigid trip into the city was this morning. The contract covering 33,000 transit workers expired last week, and workers called the strike Tuesday morning. While the New York City transit strike has caused problems for millions of people this week, many people in Pakistan are facing much bigger challenges. It is now winter in northern Pakistan, and that's causing even more problems for the millions of people left homeless after a massive earthquake hit the region 3 months ago. Some 2.5 million people are living in emergency shelters, but hundreds of thousands of others are staying outside the camps in makeshift shelters at higher elevations that will soon be covered by snow and ice. For some people living here in the United States, the earthquake touched a very personal nerve. Iqbal Ahmad and Nyla Mogul both grew up in Pakistan and later moved to Boston, where they now work as doctors. Nyla is a pain specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Iqbal is a pediatric anesthesiologist at Tufts New England Medical Center. They both went back to Pakistan after the earthquake to help people there, and they now join us in studio to talk about that experience. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Pleasure to be here, Deborah.
Let's start with you, Nyla. Tell me why you decided to go to Pakistan and about the stories that we've heard about how devastating this tragedy has been.
Deborah, the decision was almost automatic. It was made for me. My husband called me up one morning and said Pakistan was looking for anesthesiologists rather desperately. And so I simply started calling relief agencies as the names came into my head while I was sitting in the operating room. And it seemed that bureaucratic hassles were sort of holding me back, held me back for a couple of days. And I decided to simply take the plunge on my own. And I traveled independently.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find there?
Deborah, the scale of devastation is really quite incomprehensible for those of us who have watched it on television or have heard of stories from others. It really is from individuals to towns, to districts, to an entire region where millions of people lived and lived sort of relatively poor lives. They were mostly subsistence farmers and grew their own crops, not cash crops, but enough to live by. They all were, the towns were simply devastated. They were destroyed. When I traveled into the region of Balakot, for example, a city that had an emerging level of literacy, many, many schools, some colleges. Not a single structure was standing. The city of Muzaffarabad, the capital of Kashmir, as you would enter the city, one would realize that though some buildings were standing, none of the structures were habitable by any standards.
Iqbal, your wife was just days away from having your first child when the earthquake hit, so you put off the trip for a couple of weeks, and you got there in early November. Was it difficult to leave then, and why did you decide to go?
Well, I share the sentiments of Naila that as soon as I heard about the disaster on October 8, it became apparent over the next few hours that it was just not one luxury apartment building in Islamabad, but an entire region that had been affected, and I just wanted to go right away. But obviously, we were expecting our first child, and Noor was born on October 10th, and she had a little bit of trouble initially, so I wasn't wanting to make sure that she was going to be okay and my wife was going to be okay, and that was what delayed my trip, and I went as soon as I was assured that they would be fine.
And what did you find there?
Well, as Naila described, it's really hard to imagine, even if you see images on television and read detailed newspaper reports. 20 years ago, I did go through Balakot on a bicycle trip along the Karakoram Highway and with some friends, and we stopped there for lunch. People were very hospitable. And it was a really verdant, beautiful valley and a town in the base of the valley. When I went again last month, it was like it was basically reminiscent of scenes from Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the nuclear bomb was dropped on them. There was nothing left standing. And it was quite obvious that a lot of people had perished. The local girls' college was completely devastated with some 250 students literally buried alive in there. So it was very hard to digest this, the immensity of the tragedy.
You helped set up a hospital in a small town at one point, and an army colonel there said that you should expect 200 patients the next day. What happened?
Well, we finally, ended up with a very close friend of mine from high school who was a surgeon in New Jersey. His name is Imran. And a couple of other people that I met basically just collected together. We were placed by an Operation Heartbeat in this medium-sized village at about 6,000 feet on the top of a hill in a beautiful valley, in Jhelum Valley in Kashmir. And basically, we were told that we'd expect about 200 patients, and the first day we saw 800 patients.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're going to continue your story right after a break. Naila Mogul and Iqbal Ahmed are both doctors who recently returned from doing relief work in Pakistan. We will hear more about their work when we return. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation with Iqbal Ahmed and Naila Mogul, two doctors who both returned to their home country of Pakistan after the earthquake there to help with relief efforts. They are back in Boston, where they both now live and work, and they're joining us in studio. Naila, let's start with you once again. I'm wondering, you write about a story of a woman who suffered horribly because of the earthquake, Parijan. Can you tell that story to our listeners?
Sure, Deborah. Parijan was a woman, perhaps in her mid-30s. It's hard to tell when people themselves traditionally have not known of their own ages. She had seven children and an intact family when this had happened. Parijan lost four of the seven, and the three who were left were accompanying her when I met her in Abbottabad. And the conversation with Parijan stands out in my memory for several reasons, the most poignant of which is the fact that she was debating with me about whether to acquiesce to a foot amputation, which the doctors were recommending at the time because she suffered from severe gangrene, or to instead thinking in her head perhaps it was some kind of a trade-off that she could offer, because her hand also was very injured and quite mangled, that if she did, she should instead offer her hand. Outside the camp, her 8-year-old son, Sadakat, was waiting, and I did go and sit with him and talk to him. His face was tear-stained. He hadn't eaten in days, and for him, the loss of his entire life simply evaporating before his very eyes, and all that loss, brothers, siblings gone, school vanished, somehow did not amount to the grief that he seemed to experience at the choice his mother faced.
No, it sounds to me that this is different from some of the other horrible disasters that we've seen this year. Maybe, Iqbal, you can talk about this a little bit, because folks like Parijan are living with long-term implications from what happened.
I think I really would like to people to take from our conversation today the message that this is a long game. This is going to be not months but years for people's lives to be restored. It'll need engagement from all of us, both the Pakistani-American community here and also our neighbors and friends, to really commit ourselves to rebuilding the lives of the whole region. And I'm kind of encouraged by the fact that that is going on. People have started rebuilding. They've come out of their initial shock. They're rebuilding their homes. One vision that I have, I'll share with you. I went past one of the little structures that were being rebuilt by a family. Basically, all I could see was a young woman and two young children with spades and shovels trying to rebuild. And I wondered where the men of the family were. And the next day I went past, I saw the man of the family. He had both his legs amputated, and he was just trying to help them by giving them directions.
And I really think brings us to a rather pivotal point in this whole catastrophe that is still unfolding, and that is that these are people who live on a very rough, very irregular mountainous terrain. We must remember that this is where the three mightiest mountain ranges of the world meet, the Himalayas, Hindu Kush, and the Karakorams. And with such physical injuries, the nature of which ranges from amputations to, you know, multiple fractures, malunions, and then secondary amputations from gangrene itself, it needs to be realized that the kind of rehabilitation that needs to be offered to these people has to be far more sophisticated than what could be offered to people who live on flat surface and have to walk small distances only. These are people who walk 2 miles each way sometimes to school.
And how are people keeping warm right now in the winter?
I think that's I think primarily that's the biggest concern right now. You know, I spent 5 nights in a tent which was not winterized, and you know, with my ski outfit, I used to sleep in a sleeping bag. It was very cold. I don't think people will survive in non-winterized tents beyond the winter. What is being done is alternative means of shelter. We don't have enough winterized tents in the world to accommodate 600,000 or a million or more homeless. So they're trying to build structures of corrugated aluminum sheets. The government is trying to hand them. People are really, they know what's coming. They're trying to be part of the reconstruction themselves. They're trying to rebuild their homes. I think it will be very useful for these people to receive alternative methods of keeping them warm, including
sleeping bags. I think there is a severe shortage of blankets as we speak. The word has been put out. There's always a delay in the need as it arises, and when the word finally gets out, the nature of the need itself has changed. This is what happened with the cry for tents. By the time they actually started rolling in, the weather had already taken a turn, and so there was a need for winterized tents at that time.
Right.
And the world took its time sort of catching up.
We only have about a little bit more than a minute now to finish our conversation, so I'm just wondering, do you see, is there any sort of hope in this story? And you both have children. We mentioned your newborn daughter at the start of this. What would you tell your children about something like this?
Deborah, my children are young people with an emerging sensibility of which I'm very proud. Still, instead of protecting them from the monumental adversity that I saw, the sadnesses that I wish they had been with me to see it with their own eyes, it would have done something to their character for the rest of their lives that I will never be able to achieve with getting them to read about it.
And I share that as soon as my daughter is old enough, I would like to take her there and see it for real.
Well, thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Naila Mogul and Iqbal Ahmed are physicians working here in Boston. For more information about some of the organizations doing work in Pakistan, please visit our website. Go to here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, courtroom theatrics have again taken center stage at the ongoing trial of Saddam Hussein.
لذلك الصهيونية والأمريكان المسؤولين يكرهون صدام حسين.
In court today, the former Iraqi president accused U.S. officials of lying when they denied beating him, and he called President Bush a liar for saying that there were chemical weapons in Iraq. Also, the judge dismissed a courtroom guard and a prosecutor threatened to resign because the presiding judge was not keeping order. All of this as one witness testified about alleged mass executions, though he was 8 years old at the time and he admitted to never seeing any dead bodies. Well, joining us on the line is Alan Weiner. He's a professor at Stanford Law School and a former attorney with the State Department and the U.S. Embassy in The Hague. Professor Weiner, do these events in the courtroom surprise you?
They do surprise me. We expected, I think, that this trial would be a little bit ragged. This is the first time, of course, this tribunal has sat. It's a new court. It's being constituted from scratch for the first time. And that was one of the concerns, I think, that many of us had about the idea of the Iraqis trying to conduct a trial of this magnitude and importance on their own with a reconstructed judiciary. Even those of us who were concerned about how the Iraqi judiciary would do, I think, have been surprised at the zoo-like or chaotic nature of the proceeding.
And Saddam Hussein himself, he can cross-examine witnesses, he can say he's not showing up. Why is he being given so much leeway here?
Well, this is the thing that's astonishing. You know, right before the trial began, the Iraqis amended the law governing the trial, which some people thought was an example of political manipulation of the judicial process. And one of the changes that they made to the law was to deny the defendants the opportunity to represent themselves. They had to have lawyers. And I think there was a perception that the experience of the Milosevic trial in The Hague had shown how defendants, when they represented themselves, could really turn these trials inside out. And so I remember watching some of the first days of the trial and was astonished that really, each of the defendants was able to cross-examine the witnesses directly, and each of the defendants was periodically engaged in a running colloquy with the judge. They would simply stand up and start yelling at the judge and saying, "I'm concerned about this," or "I'm concerned about this," and the response of the judge would be to answer them. Now, the problem, again, is that a new court like this, without a track record, I think Judge Amin, the presiding judge, feels that he has to bend over backwards to show that he's, extending all kinds of due process protections to the defendants.
So then could you explain just briefly then what's the U.S. role here and who's sort of the overseeing authority?
Well, the U.S. obviously was responsible for drafting the original version of the statute when the coalition provisional authority was in charge in Iraq. That law has since been reenacted by the transitional Iraqi government on its own with some changes. But when the cameras are on and the rubber meets the road and the trial commences, it's an Iraqi operation.
Hmm. Saddam Hussein is on trial for the deaths of more than 140 Shiites after an alleged assassination attempt in Dujail in 1982. You've said that few people really doubt whether he's guilty. So how can he really receive a fair trial, and what's the point of a trial?
Well, the question, Deborah, I think, is what do we mean when we say can he receive a fair trial? If, you know, we have good procedures in place that require the prosecution to, you know, produce substantial evidence of the elements of the crime to show that Saddam Hussein committed these offenses, then if we think the purpose of the fair trial is to accurately determine innocence or guilt, you know, the trial should be able to do that without much difficulty. But we, I think, expect trials to do more than be fair. And I think that's been one of the big sources of confusion about this trial. What do we want it to do, and what do we want it to try to achieve? We're looking for more than an accurate determination of guilt or innocence in this case. I think we're asking the trial to do quite a bit more. We're asking it to provide a forum for the victims to confront the individuals who abused them. I think we're looking for an opportunity to kind of establish the rule of law in Iraq and to show that no individual, no matter how powerful, is above the law. I think we're also trying to prove that Iraqi courts can conduct a fair judicial process without the intervention or manipulation of the government. And I'm a little more skeptical at this point about whether that's going to be the case with this trial, because there does continue to be pressure from the executive branch with respect to the conduct of the trial. And I think the government was hoping to use the trial for political purposes. I think it was hoping to prove to the ex-Ba'athists and insurgents in Iraq that, you know, the government was now in charge. Look, we have the former president of Iraq, your leader, Saddam Hussein, under our thumb. The problem with a trial is it's not necessarily a very good forum for doing that. The defendant walks into court with certain rights and an equality of arms and can really leave the government back on its heels.
So do you think then that maybe we're asking too much from this trial and it can't deliver, and maybe there shouldn't be a trial at all?
Well, we need to have a trial that runs effectively, and I think we need to decide what we want it to achieve. I think we need to be realistic about what it can accomplish. And I think, for instance, the idea of using the trial for political purposes, I think now it becomes quite clear that that's not what we can do with this trial. Should there be a trial at all, I am reminded of the experience of Romania after the fall of Ceausescu in that country. I don't know if you remember the images, Deborah, but the Romanians held sort of a scandalous one-day show trial of Ceausescu at a military barracks, after which he was summarily executed. Now, this was, you know, an abomination if we think about what a court process is supposed to look like and what a trial is supposed to look like. But if one wonders whether Romania or Iraq will be better served by the methods that they've chosen to try to deal with their former dictators, I think the jury is quite out on that one.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that an international court might be a better way to go?
Well, it's one thing that should have, I think, been considered from the very beginning, and I think it may be a little bit late now, but I think the way that events are transpiring show us that trying to conduct a trial like this in the domestic courts of a society undergoing a transition is very, very difficult. We're seeing now that Saddam is using the trial in very overt political fashions, in a way that I think can continue to be destabilizing to the circumstances and conditions in Iraq. And maybe it would have been better for the trial to have happened at some remote location where it wasn't as prominent a feature of the political landscape as it is in Iraq today.
All right. Well, Professor Weiner, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure to be with you, Deborah. Thank you.
Alan Weiner is an associate professor of law at Stanford Law School. By the way, Saddam Hussein's trial has adjourned until January 24th. Still to come, desperate housewife Felicity Huffman plays a very different role in the new movie Transamerica. We speak with the film's director. You're listening to Here and Now. As the debate over evolution continues, one study intended to shed light on human evolution may be making more parents concerned. The study compares the learning process in young humans and chimpanzees, and it's being done by Yale graduate student Derek Lyons, who joins us on the line to talk about his work. Derek, can you explain? You look at preschoolers and how they learn to do simple tasks and then compare that with how chimps learn to do the same tasks?
That's right. It's a task that was originally developed by two researchers, Andy Horner and Victoria Whiten. And the idea is basically to model retrieving a small toy, or in the case of chimpanzees, a small piece of food from a box that's transparent and has two compartments, one of which you can open a little door and reach into to retrieve the prize, and one of which is just an empty compartment. The trick for the whole thing is that when the experimenter models retrieving the prize or piece of food, he inserts some irrelevant actions into the demonstration. So this would involve opening the empty side of the box and, like, reaching in with a little wand and, like, tapping on the side of the box. So it's an action that has no bearing at all on the actual attaining of the goal. And what Horner and Whiten found is that the chimpanzees, when they watch someone do this, see through the fact that it's irrelevant to their getting the grape that they want, and so they completely omit it. What we've been learning in our study is that children are very bad at figuring out that the same action is irrelevant. So if you do the same thing with a child, they want to reproduce the entire action, including the irrelevant steps.
Mm-hmm. Just let me get this straight here. The children are looking at the same sort of see-through box, and to get their reward, the toy, they will do the unnecessary step of, say, going in the side of the box and tapping it. That does not have to be done for them to get their toy, but the chimps will not.
That's correct.
What if they were in a hurry? Did you time them, or were there any circumstances when the children would not do the unnecessary steps?
Well, that's really the thing that we're trying to figure out, because, of course, it's a very puzzling effect, and what's more puzzling is that it's an extremely strong effect. Basically, we've observed about 90% of the children that we tested do the irrelevant action, and what we found is that it's very hard to make them not do the irrelevant action. We do have one condition where we try and hurry them up, and rather than omitting the irrelevant actions, they just do the whole thing faster. It seems that they're genuinely convinced, having watched an adult do it, that they have to do the irrelevant thing in order to get the turtle out. Though we use little plastic turtles for this purpose.
Any theories about why? Is it sort of psychological? Do they want to impress that researcher or something? Or what's going on here? Do you know?
We've gone to great pains to try and eliminate the possible explanation that it's just the children sort of conforming to the experimenter. So one important point is that when the children act on the box, the experimenter is always out of the room. So the experimenter models the action and then explains that he has to go into the next room to get the next toy or puzzle ready. And while he's gone, the child is instructed to retrieve the turtle. So we can only, you know, tell what happened later using a little camera that we have placed unobtrusively behind the kid in the room.
So it's not social. So it must be deeper than that. What does it mean? What does this over-imitation mean then?
Well, our theory is that it has something to do with the fact that humans, relative to chimpanzees, produce a lot more complex artifacts. The kinds of tools that we use are things that are often not causally transparent. You know, you watch someone using a complex tool, and all of the things that go into making the tool operate in the way it's intended are not necessarily right on the surface for you to observe. So for chimpanzees and other kinds of primates, if you're watching another member of your species accomplish something using a simple tool, it's pretty much enough just to focus on the goal itself and then go about reproducing that goal through whatever means you individually feel are best. For humans, the thought is that imitation is such an important way that we learn about the world and about the various tools that we populate the world with, that it's become something that's quite automatic.
And what do you think the implications are to your work? I mean, I think it raises a lot of questions, obviously, in terms of imitation, learning, creativity, I mean, all of those kinds of things, aside from evolution. So what sort of things are you looking at?
We're just really interested in the way in which imitation, which is something that for a long time psychologists have regarded as, you know, a fairly simple sort of behavior, it actually seems to be something that's very complicated and, in fact, quite unique to our species.
Derek Lyons is a graduate psychology student at Yale University. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Hollywood's holiday season is here with the usual sleigh load of animated features and reworked classics, but there are a few surprises this year. Trans America is an updated road movie featuring a transgendered lead with a teenage hustler sidekick. Felicity Huffman, yes, of Desperate Housewives, plays Bree, a pre-op male-to-female whose therapist won't sign off on her sex change until Bree confronts her newfound teenage son, Toby. Huffman's performance is already setting off Oscar watch alarms. The film is also a triumph for director Duncan Tucker. It's his first feature film, and he talked about it with Here and Now's Virginia Prescott.
Welcome, Duncan.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
You say that at its heart, this is an old-fashioned movie about family. There may be some people who may disagree with that.
You know, it is an old-fashioned movie with newfangled characters. It's much more about the ways we're alike than it is about the ways we're different from one another. If I've done my job right, within 5 minutes of meeting the main character, you no longer see green neon letters flashing, tranny, 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 over her head. You just see a human being going through a pretty wild adventure.
And she's actually conservative on many levels. Mm-hmm. I think you're very compassionate in telling your story, and I wonder, have you met a Bree?
Bree, my main character, is definitely a composite of a lot of women I've met. She's a stealth transsexual woman. In other words, she passes. People in her daily life don't know her as a transsexual woman. She is prim, proper, persnickety, conservative, definitely. It's not exactly Disney, but at core, it's more about what's in our hearts, I think.
And it is a really funny movie. It's, you know, not one of your Hope and Crosby kind of movies, but one of those epic journeys where the hero gradually accepts a responsibility that they never expected and never signed up for. In this case, we have Bree reconciling with her teenage son, Toby. So we get a glimpse of this process in one scene in the car.
Fasten your seatbelt.
I don't like wearing them.
Well, I don't like the idea of seeing your internal organs splattered all over the dashboard in case we get in a wreck, God forbid, so put it on.
See this shirt? It only cost me $2.
Kel Surprise.
These shoes? You know how much these things are worth in Japan? Japanese people will kill for old Nikes.
Then you probably should avoid wearing them in Japan.
Yeah, I'd probably be, like, disemboweled by a ninja.
You don't have to say, like, probably disemboweled by a ninja is sufficient.
He's a street kid hoping to become a porn star, and she is, well, going through her own transformation. And I know you researched some young street kids or hustlers for the film, and I wondered, how do you approach the scenes like when Toby can only communicate through his sexuality?
You know, yeah, both these people are abused in some way, and yet it's not it tells the truth. They have some dark things in their backgrounds. It's not easy being a transsexual in our culture. It's not easy being a kid who's gorgeous and was taken advantage of when he was young. But they're both survivors. They both maintain their senses of humor and their capacity to dream. They're both determined. But we all have our histories. You know, we all have our pains in our backgrounds, the reason we make stories, or one of the reasons we make stories, is to show how we learn to fly.
Let's listen for a moment to Felicity Huffman talking about that performance.
And I was basically scared to death every day we shot. And Duncan can attest to that, because when I'm frightened, I'm a little bit feisty. So there are times I was like, why? Why do you want me to do that? No, I'm not going to do that. So I was frightened every day because the challenge felt overwhelming, and the cliff was so far to fall.
You know, Felicity's an amazing actor. She is a transformative actress. She's not someone who just sort of plays a version of herself from part to part, but she's somebody who can create a brand new human being and inhabit every nook and cranny of their skin, their humor and their pride and their insecurities and little hypocrisies. And it was like watching Rudolf Nureyev dance or something. It was like she would just leap into every scene, not knowing if she was going to fall on her face or not, but she would just take the dare. And I think she really captures our hearts. I think it's impossible to be an artist and try to play it safe. She never played it safe.
And she was offered this part, I believe, on the same day of her first reading for the pilot for Desperate Housewives?
she said she wanted to do the part, and the next thing she told me was that she had some TV pilot to shoot in 14 weeks. And I was like, holy cow, how are we going to get this done? You know, we haven't even started pre-production. And I didn't sleep for the next 14 weeks. And I was just thinking, during that TV pilot, it'll probably never get picked up. Who the hell cares about a TV pilot?
That TV pilot, of course, became Desperate Housewives. And I wonder if fans of that series would be shocked to see her as Bree.
I think that they might not recognize her. I mean, certainly when we started showing this movie at festivals, before people knew that Felicity Huffman was playing the lead character, they just knew she was in it. Over and over again, I had people come up to me after screening saying, where did you find that trans woman actress? Or where did you find the guy to play that role? Or people saying, I didn't know it was Felicity Huffman until I saw the credits. And she really disappears in this role.
Why did you choose not to use a trans actor, actress?
Well, if there had been a huge, wonderful number of trans actresses out there of the right age and the right looks and the right chops and talent to do this, I would have loved to have cast a trans actress. It could have been a really interesting decision. But ultimately, when I did my research with trans women and I saw how often they look like women, they don't look like guys in dresses, especially after a couple of years of hormone therapy. And if they happen to not be 6'3" and built like linebackers, they often pass very, very respectably, sometimes beautifully. And, you know, there's been a Playboy centerfold transsexual woman. I wrote the part for a stealth trans woman, and I knew that the honorable thing to do was to cast a woman to honor where the character was going, to not leave her stuck in what she was leaving behind.
In the film, a psychiatrist diagnoses Bree with a gender identity disorder.
Do you consider yourself a happy person?
Yes. I mean, no. I mean, I will be.
Miss Osborne, there's no such thing as a right answer in this office.
Yes, I'm a very happy person.
How can I help you if you won't be honest with me?
You can sign that consent form, please.
Is it Stanley's desire to become... Stanley was the character that Bree grew up as. Desire to become a woman, a mental disorder?
You know, some old school psychiatrists would possibly take that position. The more enlightened practitioners these days are recognizing that gender identity disorder, GID, used to be known as gender dysphoria, is actually a bunch of symptoms that happen when a person grows up in a culture that doesn't accept their gender properly, that suffers the psychological child abuse of being told, no, you can't be the gender you believe you are.
In the film, we cross the country, we cross these boundaries of gender and of generations. And I'm wondering if you think that some of the middle America that we often talk about might revise their opinion on an issue that red states famously oppose.
Well, you know, it would be cool to possibly open a few minds or blow a few minds. But if we just get butts in seats, as the saying goes, and people enjoy the movie, maybe there will be a little crack in some people's awarenesses, but it's not a message movie. It's not like take your medicine, eat your vegetables, learn something from this movie.
That was Transamerica director Duncan Tucker speaking with Here and Now's Virginia Prescott. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.